You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 18th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
You know what August 20th is?
I have no idea.
World Mosquito Day.
Oh, boy.
So
what? Wait, did you say World Mosquito Day?
World Mosquito Day, as in Mosquito Coast.
Did every country agree on that?
According to the American Mosquito Control Association.
Did you know that they're using mosquitoes to control malaria now? They put the vaccine in the mosquitoes and release them and so that they would spread the malaria treatment. Is that amazing?
That is amazing.
Cool.
Yeah, but how can they inject enough into a person or an animal?
That's a good point.
I don't know. What do I look like, a mosquito scientist?
World Mosquito Day originated in 1897 by Dr. Ronald Ross of the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, and he's credited with the discovery of the transmission of malaria by the mosquito, and he was honored with the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1902.
Cool. Oh, yeah, that deserved it. Absolutely. They had no idea what the hell was causing it. Didn't they think it was swamp gas or something silly?
Initially, like, yeah. Did you know that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States, was formed to fight malaria in the southern United States?
No. It was killing millions.
Which they successfully eradicated.
350 to 500 million cases of malaria occur worldwide, and a million people die still to this day.
But now they're talking about wiping it out with a vaccine. Good old vaccines.
Yeah. I wonder if Jenny McCarthy's against it, though. So.
Yeah, right. Tomorrow is the 2-year anniversary of Perry's loss.
Oh.
Like it was yesterday, practically.
Yeah.
Not 2 years have gone by. 2 years now passed, and we still get emails. We still get people writing into us telling us, new listeners to the show, what an impact Perry has had on them and how much they've enjoyed listening to him. And that's very, very rewarding to us that we still get that kind of feedback. And not that it's unexpected, but it still is fantastic to hear.
Yeah, every time there's a monkey story in the news, someone sends it in and says, this made me think of Perry. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, and a listener just recently sent us in this really cool poster. I think we're going to try to put it on our homepage or somewhere on the website.
It's great.
Of a Perry quote, which is actually a really funny quote. It's the SGU proved that birds can plan ahead. Whenever they see a monkey, they plan on getting their ass kicked.
I forgot about it too.
The guy's name was Sean Dowling from QLD Australia.
So thank you, John.
Yeah, that's Queensland, by the way.
So, and of course, on September 12th, during the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism in New York City, we will be holding the second annual Perry DeAngelis Memorial SGU Live Show. Tickets are still available, so take a look at the NECSSCon website. You can get to it again from the SGU homepage.
We miss you, Perry.
So let's go on to some news items. The first one is a follow-up on a battery story that we did about a year or so ago. So as we're moving into our new green economy and every car company now is looking to get either electric, like plug-in electric hybrids or even full electric vehicles are just really starting to come on the market, and ones that are having somewhere near a range and a recharge time that they can make some market penetration. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we have, and no one's announcing an all-electric car that has the range and recharge convenience that I think it's going to be a completely mainstream car. But we're getting close. The batteries are definitely the limiting factor. So there's a lot of attention being paid to battery technology, and I read a lot of different news items about this or that battery upgrade and what's on the horizon. About a year or so ago, we reported on a research being led by Yi Kui, who figured out that he could use silicon, like nano crystals, in order to increase tenfold the number of electrons that could be held in the anode of a lithium-ion battery. So this could dramatically increase the capacity of the kind of batteries that are being used in electric vehicles and also batteries for laptops and a lot of other things.
Yeah, they were saying up to 10 times the charge.
So here's the thing, though. But in the article, it says that, and I think we report on that 10 times the charge, holding 10 times the charge at the anode. But Qi is quoted as saying in this article that this battery could hold as much as 50% more energy per weight, which didn't really quite jibe with the 10 times the charge.
Yeah.
But I was able to figure out by doing further reading what's going on here. So, you know, of course, batteries have an anode and a cathode. Generally speaking, the anode is where the electrons are stored, and then the cathode has to receive those electrons in order to generate the current, mm-hmm. right? So all they're talking about just changing the anode in these batteries. The cathode will be the same. So it doesn't necessarily translate into, you know, one for one in terms of the overall capacity of the battery, because it'll have to increase the size of the cathode, I guess. And by the base, essentially, there's other components to the battery as well. So it doesn't necessarily mean the battery as a whole structure will have 10 times the capacitance, the capacity, as the previous designs. It just means that the anode is that much more efficient. But when you add it all together, they think they could cram in 50% total more energy per weight with this technology.
It's still a big leap.
Yeah, 50%. I mean, you figure take a car from having a 100-mile range to 150-mile range. That's pretty significant. This is not quite there. We still need to get to 250, 300, I think.
And if you look at how batteries have evolved over their life, they've been very small steps for the most part.
Incremental,
yeah,
absolutely.
Very incremental. This,
yeah,
incremental. In comparison to those, is a big step.
Yeah, it's a big incremental step, but it's still largely incremental.
Did they say how long this would take to come to market or anything along those lines?
Well, we're not even there yet. We're not even there yet. So what we reported on previously was just that breakthrough of using the silicon nanowires to increase the anode capacity by 10 times. But however, it turns out the follow-up to that breakthrough was that these nanowires didn't last very long. So they tended to break. So they weren't very durable, which means they wouldn't survive a lot of recharge cycles, which means it wouldn't be very useful. So what Qi did is he is using carbon nanofibers, right? You got to love that, right, Bob? And he's wrapping the silicon nanowires in carbon nanofibers in order to give it stability. So it'll have the increased capacity of the silicon with the stability of the carbon. And it'll have about 6 times the charging capacity. So not quite up to 10. It's a compromise, but still about 6 times the charging capacity as an all-carbon anode. And that's what Qi calculates will get up to about 50% greater storage capacity. Now, but Jay, that's always the question. You read about these, you know, in the lab, interesting breakthroughs, and what you don't know is it going to scale up, right? Is it going to have all the properties that a battery needs, which means that it has a lot of capacitance, the materials that are being used are cost effective, it'll have a lot of recharge and discharge cycles, it'll be able to generate enough energy at once to run a car.
And light enough.
It'll be light enough because weight is very important if you're dragging the battery around.
It has to work with other battery components.
It has to be compatible with whatever's out there already or force a lot of changes in the industry. So it's tough. It's to have all those features. And then it'd be nice if it wasn't weighed down with toxic materials that would then be clogging up landfills when the batteries get thrown away. The existing battery technology has mercury and stuff in it, so that's kind of a downside.
Mercury. Batteries cause autism, man.
Yeah, right. So
it has to obey the law of physics. That's
yeah,
a big
I know.
One.
Those pesky laws of thermodynamics and stuff.
You know, I just would think that with all these engineers that are out there and all the different companies that would benefit amazingly so from an increase in battery power and everything, that something would have come up by now. But it just surprises me that there's this one guy.
It's not Jay. It's not. There's other researchers doing this as well. This is just this one guy's one research program. But the reason why we've only had these incremental improvements and no big breakthrough is because it's damn hard. It's not for lack of trying. It's because it's
absolutely
a tough nut to crack because it has to have all of these features. You may find something like this guy did. Wow, 10 times the capacity, but it's brittle as hell. So there's so many deal killers with any technology to really find the like the a really superior battery is very difficult.
Oh, it just goes to show you, in a general, in sort of a cultural sense, we take our technology for granted very much.
Yeah, right.
And we don't realize exactly how much, you know, energy, time, resources, experiments, failures have gone into
yeah.
getting us to the place we are today.
You know, it's funny. We get so used to it. Evan, you're right. We're so used to it rolling out and, you know, upgrades and everything, especially today. Like, man, they make massive improvements on things all the time, and we experience this all the time. And I'm like, come on, hurry up with the battery technology.
Let me know when I can stick it in my iPhone.
Right. I mean, we get so spoiled by computer technology and Moore's Law, you know, realize it's not all technology works that way. When I was studying, when I was researching this news item, I also came across the Super Iron battery. Have any of you guys heard of this?
No.
Super
it
Iron.
It sounds
yeah.
awesome.
So this is another type of battery technology that they're working on that's going to be coming out. This one, I think, is either farther along than this, you know, the silicon crystalline battery technology. And this is, again, the goal is to try to find anodes and cathodes that have a lot of, that can store a lot of electrons and can transfer and receive a lot of electrons, so that's, you know, the density of the electricity it becomes greater. And so what they found is that if you use potassium ferrite or barium ferrite, so a certain kind of iron, in this new class of batteries, that it can hold many more electrons. Yeah. So again, interestingly, they're saying this would be compared to like a regular alkaline battery, like the kind that you would put into a toy. This will have 50% higher capacity. This technology. So again, that's supposed to be a huge breakthrough. This 50% higher capacity. So these I think we may be seeing within, I don't know, a year or two, it sounds like.
Cool.
This incremental crap, though, is going to end eventually. I mean, look at the advancements that we're seeing when we're incorporating just a little bit of nanotechnology into some of these batteries. What's going to happen in 20 years or so when we really get nanotechnology going and we start developing batteries from the ground up using nanotechnology? You're going to see some huge leaps in efficiencies and all those other parameters you talked about, Steve. That's what I believe. That
yeah,
we're
started
see a
right,
huge
Bob? Like,
jump.
It's going to be ridiculous, the advances that nanotechnology are going to present on an engineering level.
I'd like to think so, but I also remember thinking like 20 years ago that we would have been much farther along in battery technology than we are now.
Steve. Or even solar technology.
Yep. I agree.
Or in solar, you're right. Yeah. I mean, there are certain things where I remember I've been anticipating this crap for the last 20, 30 years, and it seems like we've only been making these really
but
incremental
improvements. Steve, the oil companies buy off this technology. It's out there,
yep.
man.
There you go.
They're funded by the pharmaceutical companies. Big pharma. They don't
and
want
the insurance
you.
Industry.
That's right. They don't want
and you. And in turn, they're run by the men in black.
I want to be a shill for the pharmaceutical companies. I am. Listen, if you're in the pharmaceutical company, call me. You can hire me.
Yeah, if they're going to think that we're paid off, we might as well actually be paid off.
That would be nice, yeah.
Dude, I would be like Mr. T with all my bling. I'd have crunk. I would be awesome.
You'd have crunk?
Yeah.
Crunk.
Can you even define crunk?
It's a dance
teeth jewelry.
Crunk is that's a grill.
When I smile.
That's a grill.
When I smile, I want it to say SGU.
Krill?
You are so white.
Jay, with my conspiracy money, I'm going to pay to have your crunk removed. So I don't have to look at it.
Whitey corn good.
Well, let's talk about the new superplanetary nebula. We'll go from the super iron battery to the superplanetary nebula.
No, we're going to go from super crunk to the super nebula.
Don't you love when they find new classes of stellar objects? I just love when that happens.
Yes.
This is exactly – I knew you'd love that, Rebecca. This is exactly what a team of scientists from Australia and the United States have recently announced. They reported this in a journal called Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society.
I didn't get my copy this month. Go ahead.
That they found what they're calling superplanetary nebulae, as Steve said, or nebulae, I guess is the plural pronunciation. If you don't know what a planetary nebula is, before this announcement, an astronomer might have said something like that it's the later stage of the life of stars that are the sun's mass or less. And what causes the planetary nebula is the outer atmosphere of the star are blown off for various reasons. And this blown off atmosphere of the sun, of the star, forms an expanding shell of gas and dust, which of course exposes the core of the star, and the core is actually still kind of evolving into a white dwarf. It's not quite a white dwarf yet, but it emits intense UV radiation that ionizes the gas that's expanding around it. And this makes, I'm sure a lot of you have seen it, arguably the most beautiful objects in the universe. Just seriously, just do a Google image search for planetary nebula. You'll see the most amazing images.
Now, can I just say, though, that what's with the misnomer? I mean, couldn't they have fixed that when they figured out that these things were not actually planets?
Yeah, but
it is a little annoying, yeah. Mm.
It is. It's one of the nastiest misnomers in astronomy. But when they first saw this astronomical object in space, to those astronomers, it looked like the gas giants that we were able to resolve very, very poorly in our very primitive telescopes. So it kind of, you know, the disc shape of the planetary nebula kind of reminded them of the gas giants of our solar system. So that's where the name came from. And then it was many, many years later that they realized that, hey, wait a second, this is a diffuse gas that's expanding in a shell around an exploded star. It was too late, and you know how it goes with names like that. It totally stuck, so we're stuck with it. And whatever, you know, you're right.
Don't we normally
I agree.
Just call them nebulae anyway?
No,
common parlance, or is that different?
It's different. Nebula would just be gas illuminated. Yeah, just gas that's being illuminated by, say, stars behind it. Not they weren't created by any of those stars, so it's definitely a different class of object. So you just can't really say just nebula. It's a type of nebula, and what the hell. Planetary nebula. That's
I mean,
what
it's not
got.
Hierocotherium, but, you know, it's pretty bad.
About 5% of the audience was dying right now.
All right, guys, but this phase is very brief, though. It only lasts about 10,000 years, and I know that sounds like a lot of time, but compare that to the multi-billion-year lifespan of the star.
The blink.
And that's just a flash in the
pan. Yeah, it's a camera flash.
What? Yeah. But now, so one problem with this scenario is that the problem with the heavier stars. If you've got one solar mass or less, you end up pretty much with a planetary nebula. If you've got about 8 solar masses or more, then you get a neutron star or a black hole. So what about the 1 to 8 solar masses? What's going on with them? Now, scientists for years predicted that they would also produce a planetary nebula, but they could never find them. And they actually even called that the missing mass problem. But don't confuse that with the missing mass problem that led to the discovery of dark matter. Completely
different
problem.
Thank you.
All right, Jay?
Stop doing that, Jay.
So as you may have guessed, the latest study seems to have found these planetary nebulae that are created from the heavy stars. The scientists found them. They were looking at the large and small Magellanic Clouds, which are satellite galaxies next to the Milky Way. They're relatively close, about 170,000 light years away.
Yeah, but you can only see them in the southern hemisphere.
Oh,
yeah, I know.
What the hell? Oh, hence the Australian-American.
Hey, next year we'll have to take a look, Steve.
Let's get to a big telescope and start looking at these things.
That's
we're
true.
Down
you
there.
Know what? We're going to be in this. This will be for me. I don't know about you guys. Will be the first time I will be in the southern hemisphere.
Me too.
And really get to see the southern sky. You know, all the stuff.
I can't wait.
I want to see the Southern Cross.
I hear the southern constellations and
that's in the north.
The southern
Jay.
Sky is much more much more impressive than our northern sky.
I mean, we have Orion. Orion's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's the primary one.
And the Big Dipper.
The Big Dipper.
But Orion's got no head. All right, next thing.
He's an acraniate.
So they found 15. They found 15 radio objects when they looked at the Large Magellanic Clouds. For some reason, I don't know why, they compared their findings to the optical surveys that they did of these galaxies, and they match precisely. So that means that these 15 objects that were emitting radio waves were previously identified as planetary nebulae that they identified using optical telescopes. So this is very unusual because they're not supposed to be emitting radio waves like that. The team leader, Associate Professor Miroslav Filipovic, said that this came as a shock to us, as no one expected to detect these objects at radio wavelengths. And with the present generation of new radio telescopes, we've been holding out our findings for some 3 years until we were 100% sure that they are indeed planetary nebulae. And so bravo to them for waiting 3 whole years until they vetted the crap out of their data. I'm sure they've been dying to announce this. And one thing to remember, though, about this is that solar masses can get very confusing. For example, black holes can be formed from stars with 8 or more solar masses. The core that's left over from the supernova only has to be three solar masses, though. Mm-hmm. It just takes a star with at least eight solar masses to produce a leftover core greater than three. So it can get a little bit confusing when you're reading about how many solar masses you need. You have to distinguish or differentiate between, you know, are they talking about the mass of the star before it explodes, or are they talking about the core requirement in order for the star to become either a neutron star, a white dwarf, or a supernova, or a black hole. Right. I mean, yep.
Cool. So where are the pictures?
The one picture I kept coming across in article after article, was a little bit boring,
yeah.
but it is far away, and there is a big hope that we'll be able to see planetary nebulae like this in our galaxy once the square kilometer array that they're going to start building in a couple years, and it won't be done until 2020, but it's going to be thousands of radio telescopes that they're going to be setting up either in Australia or Africa, I believe, that should give us the power resolution we need to really see these things in our galaxy. Apparently, the radio sources aren't bright enough for some reason in our galaxy, so we need really sensitive instruments to detect them here.
And now we'll know what we're looking for, right? So it'll make it a little easier, I hope.
Yeah, I'm sure.
One more somewhat astronomical news item. This one, so a nonprofit organization that is doing research using the information coming from the Kepler probe that we talked about, I believe, last week,
mm-hmm.
Is going on a fundraising campaign to adopt a star.
But not like that scam, adopt a star, name a star.
What's
the difference?
The internet.
Yeah, but I was reading this. I'm trying to think. So what is the difference? So they were.
Well, it's like that program. So you adopt a road, and you are responsible for that road.
Yeah, you just have to clean up a star.
You
don't own the road. You don't name the road. It's just,
Bob,
you know,
that's bullshit. That's my road.
Well,
Jay set up a toll booth.
But this new one, you can plant your personal flag on your star using Google Sky.
Right, that's the perk for $10 per star,
yep.
Right?
And also, yeah. I think the difference is that the money goes to a good cause as opposed to a private company
that's profiting.
Yeah. So they're looking to raise $1 million in order to fund their research by selling 100,000 stars at $10 a pop. So, but you're right. It isn't. You know, the star isn't going to like really be named after you. It's not an official, any kind of official, you know, stellar naming thing. So as long as they're really 100% clear about that. But I could see how people still might be confused, mm-hmm. especially since this is like actual astronomers.
Yeah, I think people understand though that the point is a fundraising idea, and I don't know. I think it's a fun way to raise money and to get people
absolutely
looking at the sky.
I mean, yeah. Could you ever make it official? Yes, I have the authority. I have the authority to freaking name the stars and, you know, register them to people. Like, who could do that?
The International Astronomical Union, right?
Well, the Astronomical Union.
There's our
IAU.
That's their job.
Well, there you go. Why don't they do it? See, now they're sitting on a gold mine, Trebek, right there.
That would just taint the whole enterprise.
No, it wouldn't.
No, but officially, this star here is Joe Schmo,
it wouldn't be that, Bob. It would be this star here is the Citibank star.
Yeah, right.
This
one is Paris Hilton.
In 5 years, it'll be overturned to be the Dunkin' Donuts star once Citibank goes.
Hey, I mean, there are, you know, what, 100 billion stars in our galaxy, so there's a lot to go around.
Yeah. They only want to name 100,000 of them. It's nothing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the 100,000 that the Kepler is actually looking at.
Yeah, the 100,000 in Kepler's field of view.
Speaking of stars,
yeah,
we're still having that star party right before DragonCon this year where you can come out and hang out with Pamela Gay and Phil Plait, and I think there's still tickets available. The Atlanta Skeptics are putting it on.
Cool.
And everybody's coming to DragonCon, so just come a day early. It's Thursday night, and it's going to be fantastic dinner, drinks, stargazing, awesomeness, and it all benefits the American Cancer Society on behalf of, or in honor of, Jeff Medkeff, the astronomer who named an asteroid after me.
One more quick news item. This one has to do with UFO sightings in the UK.
So recently, the Ministry of Defense in the UK released 800, the details of about 800 UFO sightings. And the interesting thing is that when these sightings were put on a timeline, they correlated quite strongly to the release of alien-centric shows and movies like The X-Files, Independence Day. I was reading one blog that noted a big drop, I think, in 1980 when Doctor Who was canceled. I think it was 80. I'm not
really
sure. yes. So it's just an interesting sort of thing to notice that these shows could be putting UFOs and other sort of paranormal events into the population, the general populations, to the forefront of their minds, and causing them to maybe see things that they wouldn't otherwise see. One of the busiest years that they saw was 1978, and that happens to be the year that Close Encounters of the Third Kind was released.
Yeah.
Another big year was 1996. I think that was when Independence Day came out.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously correlation does not necessarily equal causation, but I think it's a pretty strong argument because you look at, you know, there have been past studies that have shown, I think Joe Nickel actually did an overview of the way aliens have changed shape over the years and how those correlated with the aliens that we were seeing in books, comic books, movies, television shows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, media strongly influences the way that people react to the world around them, and especially in the case of UFOs and aliens.
Yeah, it basically, again, is another feature of the psychocultural, you know, origin of the UFO phenomenon, right? It's interest and reports are responding to spikes of interest in the culture, like a blockbuster movie coming out. So no surprise, and completely compatible with the psychocultural hypothesis. Bob, just to cap the news segment this week, you're going to test out a new item, a new segment of the show called the Science News Headline of the Week.
Yeah, I'd like to call it the best science article title this week. Something it's
yeah, but Steve's name was catchier, actually.
Regardless of what we call it,
the plan.
This title just made me laugh, and I thought everyone would like it.
Can we call it "Who's That Headline"?
That headline.
Who's that wordy?
So the title was "Blue Tits Embrace Aromatherapy."
Really?
I didn't even read it.
Wah.
I didn't even read the article. I didn't have to read it. It's just very funny. It's got the whole
science,
sexual, skeptical angle to the whole thing.
It's got tits and embrace in the same sentence.
Yeah.
You
know? Mm-hmm.
I love the skeptical angle with aromatherapy. So
yeah.
It's got a little bit of everything.
Something for everybody. Good job.
Although it doesn't have – I actually read the article, Bob, because I saw the headline too. It doesn't have anything to do with aromatherapy or tits, it turns out. Not in the sense that Jay would like it to anyway. So these are birds, obviously, and they do use leaves and berries and herbs and stuff that they find in order to scent their nest. But what they're really doing is these substances reduce the amount of bacteria and parasites and stuff in the nest.
Yeah, that's not aromatherapy.
No, it's using drugs from the environment.
I do not think that word means what you think it means.
Exactly.
Inconceivable! I could have seen it if maybe they were using some kind of smell that relaxed them or something.
Yeah. That was a real stretch.
Yeah.
The aromatherapy thing was a real stretch.
Yeah. Headline fail.
Your title has blue tits in it. Do you really need to spice it up with anything else?
Hey, Larry, shouldn't we throw some facts in here about the headline? No need.
It's like the guy started with, hey, I'm working on this headline. Blue tits.
You know? Something, something, something.
Yeah, something, something.
It's great. I love it.
Print it.
All right, well, let's go on to a couple of your questions and emails. The first email comes from Corey, who writes, "Hi, SGU, love the show. My only complaint is that it only comes out once a week. I was wondering what you all thought about the aquatic ape theory. The theory that humans in their past have an ancestor that spent time in the water as a way to explain our subcutaneous fat layer, our hairlessness, our ability to control our breathing, etc., all of which differentiate us from the apes. Is it pseudoscience? If not, why doesn't it have broader acceptance and or inquiry? Thanks.
We got 7,000 questions about that.
Yeah.
7,000.
Yeah, this literally has been around for a long time, and then we've got this spurt of emails asking us about the aquatic ape theory. I think it's because the main proponent of it, Elaine Morgan, actually spoke at the TED conference recently. I think that's
what was she doing speaking there?
Yeah, I know, huh? I think that's what brought it back up to the surface. But this has been around for a long time, a really long time. So the notion that a human ancestor was somewhat adapted to an aquatic environment was first raised by Sir Alistair Hardy, who was a marine biologist, in the, I guess, around the 1960s. And then it was mentioned by Desmond Morris in The Naked Ape in 1967. It had a couple of pages in the book, The Naked Ape. But then I don't think it really took off until a few of modern supporters really started to promote the idea. Most importantly, Elaine Morgan, who wrote The Descent of Women and then also wrote The Aquatic Ape in 1982. And that's, I think, what really put it on the radar, is the book by that name, The Aquatic Ape. So this is just a really beautiful pseudoscience. It really is pure, pure pseudoscience. It's a lot of fun, though, to dissect it. The thing that's really interesting about it is that a lot of people get hit out of left field with this. You know, they either read the book or an article about it or a lecture. And it's one of those situations where if you take a lot of information that seems to support one point of view, it could seem like a very compelling case, you know, especially if you don't know all of the nitty-gritty details or you don't really dig deep on each specific claim. So immediately, like, you invoke your pattern recognition, like, yeah, wow, there's all these things. It does seem to all add up and make sense that, you know, we're adapted to an aquatic environment. But when you start to scratch even just barely beneath the surface, it really all starts to fall apart. For example, one of the main lines of argument promoted by Morgan and other, you know, proponents of the aquatic ape theory is that humans are hairless, and that this adaptation is found only in aquatic mammals, among mammals, only in aquatic mammals and burrowing mammals. And since we're not a burrowing mammal, well, then we must be adapted to the water, right?
That kind of narrows it down.
Kind of narrows it down. But this is a massive exercise in cherry picking.
What about the aerial ape?
The aerial ape.
The fire ape.
For example, what about pigs? They don't have a lot of hair. Well, so then they get around those kind of counterexamples by playing footloose and fancy free with their definitions. Well, they say, well, pigs are wallowers. They wallow in mud, uh-huh, and that counts as aquatic. Huh?
Right. Yeah. So yeah. If you wallow, if you're a wallower,
yeah,
that's aquatic.
That's aquatic. Which always then, you know, leads to the question with this theory. Well, how aquatic is aquatic? And one of the fallacies that they commit is to just, you know, again, just change the definition of how aquatic is aquatic as needed to accommodate whatever they want.
Move the goalposts.
It's exactly as aquatic as it needs to be for any individual argument, but it doesn't have to all hang together and make sense, right?
So that's at one end of the spectrum, they wallow in mud, and the other one, they're at 6,000 feet.
Yeah. So there are counterexamples of mammals that are hairless that are not really aquatic. And also, out of about 31 groups of mammals that have adapted to a semi-aquatic or aquatic environment, only 3 are relatively hairless. The other 28 have hair, like, you know, like beavers and otters, right, for example. So it's actually not a feature. The hairlessness is actually not a feature of aquatic adaptation. In fact, the only species that are aquatic, the only mammal species that are aquatic that are hairless, are also very big. And in fact, there are lots of large terrestrial mammals that are also relatively hairless, like the elephant and the rhino and the hippo. It has more to do with heat regulation and body size than it does to, you know, to being adapted to the water. Of course, then they make ridiculous statements that, like, rhinos are spend a lot of time in the water, which is just absurd.
Or I mean, near the water.
Hippos do, but rhinos
looking
no.
at the water.
No. So they you know, essentially sort of tweak the facts as needed, you know, and sort of ignore the facts that are inconvenient. So if you look at hairlessness, it's really not an adaptation of aquaticness. It has to do with size and thermoregulation. And there's lots of different examples of hairless mammals that are not aquatic. Also, again, this is where, you know, you see the difference between looking for a superficial similarity and then using that as an argument for a hypothesis, the superficial similarity of, like, whales and people have relatively little hair, and not formulating an argument that hangs together when you really start to think about the details. For example, the mammals that are aquatic, that are hairless, not only are all large, but they are the most adapted to the water. They have that their evolutionary line has been adapting to an aquatic environment for tens of millions of years, whereas hominins have not been around for tens of millions
of years.
Right? So this is where they play with the definition of how aquatic is aquatic. We've been aquatic long enough to acquire whatever features they're saying are aquatic, but not long enough not to have any of the features, you know, that we're missing. So again, they could just arbitrarily decide how long that is. But in fact, if you try to make an actual comparison between species that are adapted to an aquatic environment, we don't fit them in any way. We don't have the same features.
And one of the things that interests me is that if we spent millions of years in the water, why did we suddenly develop really terrible ways to deal with being in the water,
yeah,
like a tendency to inhale when we go under the water, which obviously will lead to us dying. And,
right,
you know, we actually drown pretty easily for, you know, a species that supposedly spent millions of years in the water.
There's even such a thing as, I think they call it dry drowning, where you're basically, I think, panicking so much that your throat closes up and you just can't, you know, no water, you drown, but no water actually even ever gets into your lungs because your throat just said, that's it, I'm done, I'm closing up, nothing's going in or out.
Yeah, the broader concept there is that there are features that are pretty ubiquitous among aquatic mammals, and we don't have those.
Yeah,
the ones that they say we have are not really aquatic features, and the ones that we would expect we would have, like not drowning, we don't have. In fact, mammals that are aquatically adapted develop the ability to hold their breath for a long time. Actually, they're not holding their breath in the way that we hold our breath. Seals and dolphins and similar animals, they can store a lot of oxygen in their blood. They don't have to hold a lot of air in their lungs. But humans, for example, when you take a deep breath and hold it, the reason why you take a deep breath is because you're surviving off the oxygen in the air in your lungs. Try this experiment. Exhale as much as you can and then hold your breath. You last for seconds. You can't do it because we don't have enough oxygen in our blood. We need to continue to exchange it with the air in our lungs. In fact, when you take a deep breath and then you're gasping for air, that's because of buildup of CO2, not because of lack of oxygen, because you're exchanging it with the air in your lungs. But exhale and do it. Now you run out of oxygen very, very quickly. So the bottom line of all that is we don't have the same adaptations to deep diving that aquatic mammals have.
Although, Steve, if you do deep breathing exercises before you hold your breath, you can extend your stay under the water a bit, right?
A bit, yeah. But that's because you're getting rid of some of the CO2.
And isn't it also because you fill the little tiny things in your lungs? What are those called?
The alveoli?
The alveoli.
Copula.
The air sacs, basically. So, yeah, more air you get in there, the better you'll be, the more air you'll have to exchange oxygen with the blood, and you'll be able to go a little bit longer.
So yeah. It's not that the deep breathing ups the oxygen in your blood a little. It's getting rid of the CO2. Is that what you're saying?
Right, right. It's getting rid of CO2.
Oh,
it's
all right. It's, that proves your point then. It's different. It's different than the mammal fish.
Right. Yeah, and another adaptation of the hairless aquatic mammals is in their skin. The keratin in the skin layer is really flattened and smooth, and also is more watertight. But humans don't have, we have more of the flaky keratin on our skin. So it's not smooth and we get waterlogged. You know, our skin is not adapted to being in the water.
Steve, what about polar bears?
That's a good one.
That they have hair.
Well, yeah, they're semi-aquatic. You know, they still have hair. But, you know, if you think about it, like otters are a great example. They're more aquatically adapted than the aquatic ape theory says that our, alleged aquatic ancestors were. They still have
and they those. All have barbershop mustaches. I mean, what's with that?
They're adorable.
is there anything in the fossil record to indicate that we derived from?
Yeah, that's another big thing, is that there really aren't any fossils to suggest that there was ever an aquatic ape. And I think that they've tried to explain that by saying that those fossils would be buried somewhere at the bottom of the ocean or something like that. But
well,
it doesn't quite hold up, right?
One piece of evidence from the fossil record is that creatures that live on the shore or in the shallows, like they're saying we did, they actually are much more greatly represented in the fossil record than creatures that live on dry land, right? So you're more likely to fossilize, to leave representations behind. The number of human fossils from this period of time is more consistent with a terrestrial lifestyle than an aquatic lifestyle. That's a matter of statistics. That's kind of a soft argument. But for what it's worth, it does favor more of a terrestrial history for our ancestors. Now, Morgan and others have made a lot of play over the fact that if you look at the microfossils found with human fossils, that it's not consistent with life on the savanna. And this is another way in which they just misrepresent the definitions and facts and create straw men, is that Morgan is saying that the straw man argument there is that the alternate hypothesis is that humans evolved on the savanna, which she narrowly defines as just the grassland. But in fact, that's never been what paleontologists believe. We lived in an environment that included grasslands, but also wooded areas and ground cover and trees and the kind of varied environment that you have in the transition between forests and savanna in Africa, which also probably includes some exposure to water as well. I mean, no one's saying that we have no adaptation to water or that it didn't play a role at all, just that it wasn't dominant, that it wasn't, we weren't aquatic, as it were. So she really creates a straw man to make those arguments. Again, every single argument put forward by the aquatic ape theory about like the fact that humans have subcutaneous fat and she says that's an aquatic adaptation not seen in any other primates or mammals, it's just factually incorrect. The subcutaneous fat is actually more for storing calories and for secondary sexual characteristics, not for insulation. As the aquatic ape theory assumes.
Could you describe some of these secondary sexual...
What? Why don't you go back to the first segment where we talked about boobies?
Yeah.
Yeah. Blue tits. Come on, blue tits. Here we go.
I'm sorry, tits.
Right. So, and also, there's studies that if you, keep a monkey in captivity and you overfeed it, they get fat just like people do.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
Well, duh.
So we're no different than monkeys because we're primates.
We are monkes.
We're primates.
So you're a monkey.
But the point is we're no different than the rest of the primates when it comes to our subcutaneous fat. It's just that, we live a sedentary lifestyle.
And plus, we have Twinkies.
Yeah,
they don't.
Yeah, exactly. We have. If you feed monkeys Twinkies, they get fat.
Enough about your Twinkies. God.
Hey.
Before we move on to another topic, I have one final point to make on this. Do you all say aquatic?
Yes, aquatic. Why you say aquatic?
It's aquatic.
It's aquatic.
Aquatic,
you have a funny accent. That's all. It makes me chuckle every time you say it. Aquatic.
Rebecca,
you sound like a duck.
From New Jersey, moved to Boston. You're so New England, it's ridiculous.
Aquatic.
Who are you correcting?
Aquatic actually is Boston.
Aquatic. I just think it's aquatic. Funny. That's all.
Pack the aquatic.
I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's funny.
There is one more conceptual point I want to raise about the aquatic ape theory. It is an example of extreme environmental determinism. The theory basically is that the environment will completely determine the features that an animal evolves. If you are in the water, then you will develop aquatic features, period. In fact, it ignores the well-established principle of evolutionary biology that animals or creatures can evolve different strategies to adapt to the same environment. Not every animal that adapts to the water or to any particular environment needs to adapt the exact same strategies. And on the other side, that features can evolve as an adaptation for different purposes. You can develop subcutaneous fat in one animal for insulation, in another for calorie storage, and another for secondary sexual characteristics, and some other animal may find yet some other purpose for subcutaneous fat. So the modern view of evolution just conceptually is not in accordance with this extreme environmental determinism of the aquatic ape theory. I guess the answer to your question, Corey, is that yes, it is kind of a fun pseudoscience, and it's great. It really is a great test case in how to distinguish true science and the way real science operates versus, again, the cheap imitation.
It's fun for us, but anthropologists are tearing their hair out right now.
I know,
so.
I know.
Oh, hairless. I get it.
They're hairless. Yeah.
All right, let's do another question. Question number two comes from Rhiannon McKeon from Sydney, Australia. Actually, she just said Sydney. I'm assuming it's Australia. Is there another Sydney somewhere?
Yeah, there's her boyfriend, Sydney.
Sydney, Michigan.
I have a husband named Sydney. There's a Sydney in the Midwest, isn't there?
And she writes, I was hoping that Steve could clear up a discussion some fellow skeptics and I were having on Twitter. Can you build up an immunity to caffeine over time? I am 23 and I've been drinking coffee tea for 10 years and now don't have any trouble getting to sleep after having a late night coffee, whereas when I was younger, I could have considerable trouble. Is this just a factor of age or a buildup of resistance to its effects? Well, that's a very good question. I wouldn't use the term immunity because immunity implies that your immune system is somehow involved, and that's not the case. You have no immune response to caffeine. The molecule is too small, really, to provoke an immune response. But I know what you mean. You mean resistance. Or actually, the technical term is tolerance. When you talk about a drug that has a decreasing effect over time because of changes that it provokes with chronic use in the body, that phenomenon is called tolerance. So the real question is, does caffeine have tolerance? Not all drugs do. Some do, some don't. What do you guys think?
Yes.
I would think. I mean, I think people can adapt to like the diuretic effect of caffeine. I'm pretty sure about that. But I would say yes, that you could definitely learn to tolerate it.
I heard somewhere that caffeine never actually gives you a boost, that it simply replaces a chemical that's already in your brain and your body makes less and less of it as you give your body more and more of it. And so when you take it away, that's not true?
No. So
no,
here's
aquatic.
I've been lied to.
Here's a lie. Caffeine does give you a boost, but it does have tolerance. It has actually very rapid tolerance. It can sometimes, to some of the effects, even within days, like the sleep disturbance and the diuretic effect, maybe even just 18 days or so, you can get tolerance to those effects. What caffeine does is it binds to the receptor for a neurotransmitter called adenosine, and it is an antagonist. So it's that means it blocks the receptor. So it binds and blocks a receptor that normally has a calming or inhibitory effect. So therefore, by blocking an inhibitor, it has a stimulatory effect. So it's a CNS or a brain stimulant.
Steve.
Yep.
Sorry, what would the relationship then be to ATP, adenosine triphosphate?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just it's the same chemical, but there's no real direct relationship there.
Okay.
What happens, though, and this often happens when these kind of receptors are involved, is that by blocking these receptors, your body just makes more of them so that it compensates for the blocking of the receptors. That's called upregulation, right? So your body will upregulate the adenosine receptors to compensate for the fact that caffeine is blocking some of them, and that then reestablishes the previous equilibrium. Now, with the caffeine, it just puts you into the normal range. I will say there that model of the caffeine tolerance is not 100% certain. There are some people who think that the upregulation is not enough to account for the tolerance we see with caffeine and that there may be some other mechanism involved. But the fact that there is tolerance is absolutely established, so there's no question about that. That tolerance usually also goes hand in hand with withdrawal. If you become tolerant to a drug, then when you remove it, you then go through withdrawal. So, for example, if we go with the adenosine receptor hypothesis with caffeine, if you upregulate those receptors and then you take away the caffeine, well, then, of course, you're going to have too much inhibition. That's when you'll be sleepy and have trouble thinking and you'll, quote-unquote, crash, right? And then you need to dose yourself with caffeine just to get yourself back up to normal. And
what about the caffeine headache? I've gotten that.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a second.
I've had that.
So the thing that's interesting about caffeine is that even after a few weeks of using caffeine, all you're really accomplishing from that point forward is using it just to put yourself into a normal state, right? So you're not really getting much of a boost out of it. You're just crashing when you're not using caffeine. So it's actually not that advantageous as a long-term strategy. For energy or for alertness.
If you had let me finish earlier, I would have gotten to that part, which would have been the right part of what I do.
Okay.
You just stopped me at the wrong part.
Sorry. But, Bob, about the headache. So the caffeine has a constricting effect on the blood vessels so that when you're withdrawing from the caffeine, it causes vasodilation or an opening up of the blood vessels. And vasodilation in the head causes a vascular headache. It causes a headache. So absolutely, you get a caffeine withdrawal headache, which is very common. I see a lot of patients who come to me, you know, they've maybe even seen other physicians, and they've been having headaches, and they can't get them under control. And then I ask them, so how much caffeine do you drink every day? And I know what I'm in for when I get that little embarrassed smile. They sort of smile to themselves, and they think for a moment, then they go, a lot. You know, they give me some vague answer. And then when I really nail them down, it's amazing how much caffeine some people are drinking on a daily basis. You know, some people tell me how many pots of coffee they're drinking.
Whoa.
Or that it's like 8 to 10 is not unusual. And then I have to find out now, is that, or it might be only a few, but they're talking about these 24-ounce, stuff, things you get from Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts or something. Massive amounts of caffeine. Say that, that might have something to do with your headache.
Yeah.
And I cure the occasional patient just by getting rid of the caffeine.
I could be a doctor. That's easy.
Yeah.
I like people that go, I don't drink caffeine, and then you find out that they drink like a liter of Coke every day or...
Well, there's...
Coke or tea.
I don't Yep. Or they say, I don't drink caffeine. I drink decaffeinated coffee.
Yeah, so decaf
there's caffeine in those.
Has about 25% of the caffeine of regular. So it's harder to overdose on decaffeinated, but you can if you drink a lot of it. So anyway, so that's interesting about the tolerance withdrawal, the headaches. It's I think if more people were aware of it, maybe I wouldn't be seeing so many people with caffeine withdrawal headaches. Also, of course, if you have migraines, the caffeine and the caffeine withdrawal can stimulate or trigger a migraine. So even if you're not getting a pure caffeine withdrawal headache, people with migraines should really completely avoid caffeine.
There's a PS to this question, Steve. I don't know if you wanted to tackle that.
Oh, was there?
Why is American coffee so bitter compared to the superior Australian barista's product?
I have no idea. I don't even drink coffee.
I do. I've never had Australian coffee, though.
We will
and
have
I've
some.
I've never in my life heard that it was better. That's odd.
You have?
I haven't ever heard that.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to test that theory when we're down there.
I'd be up for that.
Steve, you don't drink coffee at all?
No.
Like, really? When's the last time you had coffee?
He's never. A tea boy.
I don't drink
you've
it.
You've never tried coffee?
I think I've tried it once or twice.
What? Wait a minute. You think you tried it?
Isn't that weird?
Come on, Steve.
Have you ever had coffee ice cream?
I don't like the way it tastes.
You don't like coffee.
No.
It's so bitter.
Oh, my God. You're amazing.
I like tea, though.
What kind of tea?
Earl Grey, if you must know.
What did you have for lunch today? Come on, what is with you guys lately?
Rebecca, come on.
This is the second week in a row where we've had like a discussion about your eating habits.
The guy's not sure. Once or twice he may have tasted coffee in his 45 years. Really? Come on.
I don't really blame him. Coffee's nasty. I had to force myself to like it because it was the only legal drug they were giving away at work.
Oh, come on. Black coffee's nasty, but throw some sugar and cream in it. Damn, it's great.
Throw sugar and cream in anything. It's almost great. Yeah, right.
Yeah, just smother it in chocolate, and you could yeah. force it down.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yes,
so ready.
You guys swept me last week. We'll see how we do this week. Item number one. A new report in cancer research indicates that U.S. cancer death rates have increased in the last decade. Item number two, a survey of 1,000 low-income children aged 11 to 16 found that 25% have been sexually active, beginning at an average age of 12 and as young as 8. And what? Item number three, a new study finds that cannabinoids, active ingredients in marijuana, can prolong and exacerbate chronic pain.
The cannabinoids, they sound like, it's like a cartoon.
Cannabinoids?
It's the cannabinoids!
All right, Jay, you go first.
All right.
You won the Chucklehead Award.
You opened your mouth.
All right, Steve, I'll go first. A new report in cancer research indicates that U.S. cancer death rates have increased in the last decade. I would definitely believe that, particularly because it said in the U.S., and I'm going to make the assumption that increase has something to do with poor diet and lack of exercise. A survey of 1,000 low-income children aged 11 to 16 found that 25% have been sexually active, beginning at an average age of 12 and as young as 8. Well, I got to tell you something. I totally missed out on this. Like, really? 8 years old? When I was 8, I think I've said this before. When I was 8 years old, my mom was still picking out my clothes for me. I had no concept of fashion whatsoever.
Hat?
Whatever. But it's ridiculous.
Sorry. Now, Jay is very sartorially advanced.
And beginning at an average age of 12 and as young as 8? Who's how? How do you hook up when you're 8? I mean, what do you say?
Hey, baby.
Want to watch SpongeBob?
Yeah, like how do you...
I'm going to show you my Wii.
Good one.
That's like... That's sick. 8 years old. I mean, that's that's not good. And the last one, a new study finds that cannabinoids, active ingredients in marijuana, can prolong and exacerbate chronic pain. That one has got to be BS because everybody knows that getting high feels good, except Steve. And cannabinoids are actually the exact opposite of that. They fight to make you feel good. And I think that one's the fake.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yep, I'm going to have to agree with Jay and say that, you know, if there's a new study that shows that cannabinoids somehow exacerbate pain, then that goes against everything we've known previously about cannabinoids. So I'm thinking that that's most likely to be BS.
All righty, Bob?
I think good job, Steve. I haven't I didn't come across any of these, first of all, so I'm gonna have to totally wing it. But the first one, the death rate, the cancer death rate's increasing. Hey, Jay, I think I'm gonna agree with you on that one. That I think our habits, you know, our exercise and dietary habits have gotten worse, and I think that might be a reason why they have counterintuitively increased. So that takes care of that one. And then the second one, first off, what does sexually active mean? What exactly does that mean?
It also presumes
a certain frequency. You're not sexually active if at 11 you have sex once and that's it. I'm assuming that it also means that you know, if there's a number there, like a few times a year whatever the hell it is. It's not a one-time thing. That,
Bob,
to me,
that's what sexually... We're talking about breaking through to the other side at age 8. That's what we're talking about.
That's at the far end of the spectrum, Jay. The average is 12.
Settle
and
down.
A 12-year-old having sex once is one thing, but to have it, you know, frequently, that's to me, that's completely different. But regardless, that's I'm okay with that. I believe it. It's not something that's blowing me out of the water. The third one though, I agree with everyone because just a few weeks ago, I saw a special on Discovery Channel about a very interesting special about marijuana, and they showed a woman on chemo smoking pot, and it lessened her requirement for the chemo. She felt better. She, you know, her appetite, of course, was good, and it was excellent. It was such a good treatment. So this one's really rubbing me the wrong way. But when you say cannabinoids, does that assume THC, or is it some of the other? Because there's lots of ingredients in marijuana. Is it the other ingredients except for THC? I'm not sure, but I'm still going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
You know, this is kind of a one that I don't know that I would necessarily have chosen. The marijuana one being false, but now having heard everyone talk about it, I must kind of go that direction, I think. But at the same time, I'm not really going to be surprised if we turn out to all be wrong on this. I think maybe chronic pain is the key phrase there. I don't know. Is chemo considered chronic pain? Or in that example you gave, Bob, I don't know. I look at chronic. I think the term chronic pain is.
I'd say no.
Yeah, I'd say it's something.
It's different.
Like trauma from a car accident you have to live with your whole life, and maybe that's the clue there. But I think I'm still going to go with everyone else and say that one's fiction.
You're going to wimp out, huh?
Yeah, I'm kind of wimping out. I'm sorry, folks. It's very
disappointing. All right, well, let's take them in order. Item number one, a new report in cancer research indicates that U.S. cancer death rates have increased in the last decade. And that one is the fiction.
Oh, no way.
Whoa.
Yep.
Oh, you must be so proud of yourself right now.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Because cancer mortality rates have been steadily declining for the last 40 years. And they continue to steadily decline. That's what the new research shows.
I mean, that's good and all, but bah.
Yeah, it's good.
You bastard.
And so this has been one of those things where our efforts against cancer have been a slow incremental improvement. Again, no big breakthroughs, no cures, you know, just slow, steady, incremental improvement in prevention, early detection, better treatment, and therefore there's been slow, steady decrease in cancer mortality. Yeah, I was hoping to try to sucker you in the exact way that I did by saying in the U.S., you think, oh, yeah, if, you know, fat Americans with our healthcare problems, that, you know, we don't have healthy lifestyles, maybe that's the problem, but... whatever effect that's having, it's being great more than compensated for by the improvements in cancer treatment.
Steve, do you really like sit around and hope that you beat us?
I like it when it's balanced. Actually, I just like the items to be good for. I hope that when you sweep me, that means I didn't do a good job, right?
Yeah.
Right. When they're balanced, and yeah.
When they're balanced, that's the best one. Because I want it to be good for the audience.
I had a much better chance of getting it right if I had gone first or second.
Yeah, you shouldn't have whipped that.
Yeah, I whipped out.
They also looked at, they broke it down to by different age groups because they were wondering maybe the advances for younger age groups were being diluted out by not so great advances in older age groups.
Yeah.
And what they found was that in every age group there was an improvement, a reduction in cancer deaths, but it was much higher in the youngest age groups. So youngest age groups have experienced a decline of 25.9% per decade, which is significant.
Wow.
And the oldest age groups have about 6.8% per decade decline. So all age groups improvement, but mostly in the younger age groups. So that is definitely a success story. Number two, a survey of 1,000 low-income children aged 11 to 16 found that 25% have been sexually active beginning at an average age of 12 and as young as 8. Of course, that one is science. And Bob, it didn't really say, but I was assuming that having sex once means you've been sexually active. You know, okay. You've had sex.
That's not the connotation I get, but yeah, I could be wrong.
But yeah, average age of 12, average of 12. That was, think about that. Of the 25% that said they've had sexual intercourse. And as young as 8, right, how do you hook up at 8 years old? But, you know, the question is, you know, why is it? Why is this the case? And, you know, some people, of course, blame the internet. I mean, basically these kids are exposed to everything by that age and get
That's
pretty
true.
Desensitized to sex. Where, I mean, at 8,
imagine us at 8, we'd be all over the internet. We'd Google every potential word you could think of.
Not to get all anecdotal on things, though. I, you know, when I was 12, 10-ish, mm-hmm.
You were a slut?
I didn't have... I was not, but you know, we didn't have the internet, and like, yeah, I knew many kids who were, who at least claimed to be sexually active, and you know, were quite knowledgeable about the subject, and that's where actually I learned most of my knowledge, was well before health class ever got around to covering the topic.
Now, keep in mind that this was low income children, so that the thinking is that, you know, that they may be more urban and also have a less stable home environment, and there's definitely a positive correlation between juvenile delinquency and sexual activity. So there's a lot of social factors at play here. So all of this means that a new study finds that cannabinoids, active ingredients in marijuana, can prolong and exacerbate chronic pain. You guys all thought this one was the fake, but this one is science. And it is surprising. And
chronic,
you know what,
pain.
Evan, you hit upon it. It's the chronic. That was the magic word in this particular science item.
Damn.
I can't believe that the chronic doesn't cure the chronic. Why would they name it that?
Wow. So what they found, this is interesting. This gets also back to the whole caffeine receptor kind of thing, where, you know, there are endocannabinoids. Obviously, if cannabinoids bind to receptors in the body, those receptors are not there unless there's some naturally occurring, you know, signal in the body that's binding to them. So there are endocannabinoids. There are naturally occurring, you know, cannabinoids in the body that use those signals. And that's what the, you know, exogenous or inhaled cannabinoids are binding to. What they found is that in the spinal cord in particular, there are receptors for endocannabinoids.
Cannabinoids remind me of, what was that, those toys I had when I was a kid?
Oh, the Bionicles? No, that's too old for us. All right. So there are, in the spinal cord, in the pain pathways, there are excitatory systems and inhibitory systems, right? It's like the accelerator and the brake are the analogy that they use in the article. What the endocannabinoids do is that they inhibit the inhibitors. They inhibit the brakes on the pain signals. So that, therefore, the pain signals become increased. And what this results in is what's called allodynia. Allodynia is when non-painful or mildly painful stimuli become painful or more painful, right? So when you disinhibit the pain pathways, even non-painful input can then be cranked up into painful stimuli. And they found that that is in fact the case when they studied the effect of binding those receptors in a rat model. They found that in fact rats had increased pain. This probably has something to do with the differences in the way acute pain and chronic pain manifest. And it's actually, to me, it made perfect sense, because we do know that a lot of drugs that treat pain are actually very bad for chronic pain, having a lot to do with long-term effects on the regulation of the pain pathways. So for narcotics, for example, narcotics will take away pretty much any pain, but chronic narcotic use can actually result in a chronic pain syndrome, and it can exacerbate and make it very difficult to treat chronic pain. So it wasn't a surprise to me that the same would be true for the cannabinoids.
So I can still take my cannabinoids for my glaucoma.
For glaucoma, sure.
And chemo.
And for chemo, I mean, the nausea is a different effect that it has, and also increasing the appetite. And it does probably numb you to the pain, but that's different than what the effect it's having on these receptors causing the increase in the chronic pain. Yeah, that was, again, superficially sounds counterintuitive, but makes sense when you look at the details. So which made it a perfect science or fiction item.
Good one, Steve.
Well done.
You win this time.
Thank you. I've noticed that a lot of the science or fictions recently have been either all one way or the other. Either I sweep you or you guys sweep me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
A little disturbing.
I'm not sure why that is.
Someone should do a study on that.
Yeah, somebody should study that.
And then give us three results and make us pick which one's true.
So, Evan.
Yeah, hi.
Please play for us last week's Who's That Noisy?
All right, folks. Perk your ears up. Here it comes.
Psychics is another one, by the way. If there's anything in it, it would be a significant genetic advantage for them to become more sexually successful over the last 2,000 years, and we would evolve to the point where there were many, many of them.
Yeah.
Yep, and that is the... he is a funny guy, if you watch this guy. Dara O'Brien. And he is funny.
I think every single one of our Irish listeners got this one correct.
Yes, that was of
course. And every single one of our skeptic listeners since I posted it weeks ago.
Yes.
It was a tip of the hat to our friends over in the Emerald Isle. You know, he's funny. I'd suggest watching as much of him as possible. And just
he's a hardcore skeptical comedian. Really good stuff.
Yeah, he's
very
rad.
Good stuff. How could we not use him at some point for a noisy? So there you are. Check him out. Now,
right, but make the next one hard, Evan.
It is.
I don't want my inbox flooded with people who all know the right answer.
Who got it first, Rebecca? Evan?
Yes, our friend Aaron Smith from Derbyshire, England, was the first one to, and actually
really?
Came through an email.
Derbyshire.
Email. Yes, yes.
This email came in 5 minutes before the podcast went up. I suspect she's some kind of time traveler.
Right.
Yes, it was close. Trinick got it last week, and
I see.
But this week to Aaron Smith. So
good job, Aaron.
Aaron with an A or an E?
A double A.
Oh, actually. Sorry.
Double A R O N.
I called him and her. Sorry.
Oh, right. Watch it.
So Evan, what do you got for us this week? Something challenging,
so let's jump into this. It is challenging. I'm going to. Well, you guys should see if you guys can figure this one out. All right, here it comes. All right.
A space shuttle.
No, it was the
thunder in slow motion.
Wrong.
The rolling boulder from
Indiana Jones.
The fifth layer of hell.
The volcano.
A fart.
Nope. 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 And
very
nope.
Small rocks.
Judges. The queen.
Very
no.
Small. But that's a good one,
but,
Evan.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's almost. Listen to it a couple times, folks, and there are some things kind of in there, maybe in the background.
Steve, you have to identify the bird in that.
Give it.
What kind of bird that was? The herconoids.
Oh, yeah, Herculoids.
Herculoids.
Yeah. The bloop and bleep.
Was it?
There was two amorphous blobs.
I have no memory of this.
And you got the rhino that could shoot little explosives.
Red bombs.
From his
thinking
horn.
About those stupid dolls I had, those stupid toys I had.
Oh, for God's
Barbie?
Sakes. What did you have for dinner tonight?
G.I. Joe.
The Herculoids.
Yeah.
All right.
Herculoids.
Well, thank you,
what a
Evan.
Terrible name. Oh, you're welcome. Enjoy, everyone.
Jay, give us a quote.
I have a very cool quote from Carl Sagan this week. I was reading Carl Sagan's biography, and he pioneered exobiology, and I didn't realize that. And exobiology, for those of you who don't know, is the study of the origin, evolution, distribution, and future of life in the universe.
Whoa.
That's awesome.
Heavy-duty stuff.
I always say this when I talk about Carl. Read his books. Read The Demon-Haunted World. That's the first book a skeptic should read. I think that's the best introduction to skepticism you can get your hands on. But Carl said, there is no other species on Earth that does science. It is, so far, entirely a human invention. Evolved by natural selection in the cerebral cortex for one simple reason. It works. It is not perfect. It can be misused. It is only a tool, but it is by far the best tool we have, self-correcting, ongoing, applicable to everything. Carl Sagan!
Awesome.
Great quote. Love it. What's not to love?
Well, a couple of quick reminders. We have DragonCon coming up in a few weeks. September 3rd to 6th. And then we have the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, September 12th. You know, look at our homepage, and you can get to the websites for details on those events. Remember to check out the SGU store. We have a lot of SGU Uncut episodes for download, so take a look.
Yeah, and those of you that are going to DragonCon, we got a brand new SGU t-shirt printed.
Ooh, that's true. We'll be bringing new, brand new swag to DragonCon.
I'd like to invite everyone to come to our forums. Very active community going on there. I'd also like to remind people, please send me your skeptical quotes.
Yep.
I really like it when people send them in.
Do Jay's work for him.
Jay prefers not to do any work.
Yeah.
So. Yes, absolutely.
And follow us on Twitter. We do announce when the shows go up, and we also will announce any really active and interesting forum threads, and we might actually put in some interesting little tidbits every now and then.
Yeah, absolutely. Very important. You know, guys, we've been planning this trip to Australia. I hate to ask again, but we need your donations to get out there. We have a lot of people that want to see us. So if you'd like to see us in Australia, please do donate. Go to our website. Give us whatever you can, and we will definitely come.
Well, thanks for joining me again, you guys.
Thank you, Steve. Good times.
Certainly.
Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.